wonderful. We could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles. We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to learn about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand, we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storms. King tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, bringing flooding on a sunny day.
Good afternoon from listener-supported community radio. This is KKRN 88.5 in the downtown Reading studio. The show is Wake Up Call, and I'm your host, Doug Craig, and our engineer today is Randy Compton. Wake Up Call is an effort to create a space through which the truth can shine. Our planet is undergoing unprecedented and massive transformation, while most of us are unaware of what this means. It's time to wake up to the climate crisis and accept our role as healers of the earth. Today's guest is Orrin H. Pilkey, the author of Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores. Dr. Pilkey is the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Geology in the Division of Earth and Ocean Sciences in the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University, and the founder and director emeritus of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines, which is currently based at Western Carolina University. Dr. Pilkey received his PhD degree in geology at Florida State University and has been a professor at Duke University since 1965. After his parents' house in Waveland, Mississippi was destroyed by Hurricane Camille in 1969, he switched his research focus to the study of coasts, a field in which he is well known internationally. In 2012, Duke University honored Dr. Pilkey with the naming of a building at the Duke Marine Lab in Beaufort, North Carolina, the Orrin Pilkey Marine Sciences and Conservation Genetics Center. Dr. Pilkey has published more than 250 scientific papers and is the author or co-author of numerous books, including The Rising Sea, published in 2009, which was his first book to focus on the global threat from sea level rise. In 2011, Dr. Pilkey and his son Keith Pilkey wrote Global Climate Change, a primer, and in 2014, he co-wrote The Last Beach, focusing on how the world's beaches are threatened by sea level rise and the challenges we face in trying to save them. The 2016 volume Retreat from the Rising Sea, Hard Decisions in an Age of Global Climate Change, co-authored with his daughter Linda Pilkey Jarvis and his son Keith, focused on sea level rise and the need to retreat or move back off the shore. His most recent book published this year is Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores, which was again co-written with his son Keith. In this latest publication, the Pilkeys argue that the only feasible response to the unstoppable impending catastrophe of global climate change is for people who live along much of the U.S. shoreline to begin an immediate and managed retreat. Dr. Pilkey, welcome to Wake Up Call. It's an honor to speak with you today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
We're really happy to have you. As we begin the show today, perhaps you could talk about how 50 years ago you chose to study coasts after a hurricane destroyed your parents' home in Waveland, Mississippi.
Yeah, at the time I was a deep sea oceanographer. I was studying, taking cores in the deep ocean and enjoying it a lot. But I must say that when I visited my parents after the hurricane and saw what a hurricane can do to a shoreline, I was so impressed. And at more or less as a result of that, I published a with my father, who retired very poorly and needed something to do. With my father, I wrote a book called How to Live with an Island. It was a quarter, 3/8 of an inch thick, and it cost $1.50. And I was shocked when I got all kinds of telephone calls and even requests to quote things from the book and things like that. And in all of my work in the deep sea, I never had a single phone call. And so I realized that studying the shoreline and sea level rise and all the events at the shoreline was something that was of interest to a lot of people and was also useful to mankind. And so eventually I gradually, shall I say, I traded a research vessel for a 16-foot skiff. And that's where I am today.
On the back of your book, you write, the consequences of 21st century sea level rise on the United States and its nearly 90,000 miles of shoreline will be immense. Miami and New Orleans will disappear. Many nuclear and other power plants, hundreds of wastewater plants, and toxic waste sites and oil production facilities will be at risk. Port infrastructures will need to be raised, and over 10 million Americans fleeing rising seas will become climate refugees. Your book is called Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, a tsunami, which can do immense damage on shorelines, of course, especially when it hits cities and towns. But it does its damage in a matter of seconds and minutes. Sea level rise does its damage in a matter of decades. But in either case, the damage is expected to be devastating.
So let's help our listeners understand, why exactly is the level of the world's oceans rising? What's causing it? How much sea level rise have we already experienced, and how much will it rise in the decades to come?
Well, the primary cause of sea level, there are two major causes. One is the expanding ocean. Due to global climate change, due to global warming, the ocean is expanding, and water does expand when it's heated, and that may be at this moment, at this time, may be the primary cause of sea level rise. But the other cause is melting of sea ice. Melting of the ice sheet, not so much sea ice. Floating ice doesn't add to the sea level rise, and that probably the most common thinking, at least in the past few years, has been that within, by the year 2100, we'll have 3 feet of sea level rise and maybe a maximum of 6 feet. But I think there's a strong belief now among scientists that the sea level rise rate is accelerating, and I think now that we should think in terms of a 4-foot sea level rise by 2100, and the possibility of an 8-foot sea level rise. That would be a maximum, absolute maximum number. There's some variation of opinion on this, but I think most of us agree that that the 3-foot per, by 2100 is now out of date, and we've got to look beyond that.
You know, many scientists who study the climate crisis often talk about how bad it will be by the end of the century. But the problem's already happening now, and as your book tells us, will last for centuries to come, which is why you write that it's very important to recognize that we're dealing with at least a 400-year problem. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's important to, because we keep talking about how much the sea level is going to rise by 2100, but it ain't going to stop there. It's going to continue to rise, and probably beyond 400 years. Who knows? That's another problem. If now this is not going to happen, but if all the ice on Earth in the mountains and in the big sea, big ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, we would, the sea will rise by 260 feet. That has happened in the geologic past. We don't know whether that's, you know, whether that's even a consideration now. That's just a factoid, I guess. But it's the potential. It has, sea level has probably in the last 100 years raised 1 foot, and the rate of sea level rise does vary from place to place because sometimes the land is sinking. And that means a much faster rate of sea level rise, or sometimes the land is coming up. Juneau, Alaska, is a good example of that. When the big ice sheet or ice glacier moved back, the Mendenhall Glacier moved back, the weight of the glacier was gone, and the land moved up. So sea level is dropping there quite rapidly.
Your comment reminded me that what a lot of people think about when they think about the ocean is that it's like a bathtub where the level of the water is the same, it's uniform around the planet, but it isn't, right? I mean, it can be higher and lower and in different parts of the ocean, and then of course the coasts are different all over the world, the shorelines, so that affects sea level rise. So it's a lot more complicated than we might think.
The bathtub idea is not really accurate. Perhaps the most widely recognized difference in sea level or impact of something other than sea level rise is the difference between the elevation of the sea on the Atlantic side of the Panama Canal and the Pacific side. On the Atlantic side, there are strong ocean currents that are pushing seawater up against the land in Panama and in Central America, and just the opposite is happening. The currents are taking water away, and there is it depends, but there's more than a foot difference in sea level rise there, or in sea level there.
That's amazing. You know, one of the things I learned in your book is that out of the 25 cities most at risk from sea level rise, 20 of them are in Florida, and yet you write that Florida is not really preparing for the disasters they're facing in the years and decades to come, especially in southern Florida and the Miami and Miami Beach area. Why are they not paying attention to this and taking this seriously?
Well, part of the problem is, well, Miami has a very difficult problem. You're right, they are not really, they're thinking about it, and Miami Beach is raising some roads and things like that. But what's happening in much of South Florida, there is this limestone that underlies the land. It's called the Florida limestone or the Florida oolite, and it is 50 to 75 feet thick, and it's very porous. Water readily flows right through this rock. And what's going to happen, is facing Miami probably within 3 or 4 decades is water coming up right underneath them, just coming up through the rocks. And they don't have a solution for that. And they can't build seawalls, they can't build jetties, they can't build levees. None of that is going to work. And so it would appear appears with certainty right now that Miami will have to be abandoned. And that's where the 4 or 6 million people will have to move to higher ground somewhere, and at the same time, right now they're still building big developments in the city of Miami, and whereas they have some committees and panels and cooperation between counties and so forth, they're not really doing anything concrete about sea level rise. My feeling is that if my parents lived there, I would say get out of there quick right now, because pretty soon the real estate prices values are going to drop. And by any rate, I don't think many people are are thinking in those terms right now.
If you're just tuning in, this is Doug Craig on Wake Up Call. Our host today, I'm your host today. Our guest today is Oren Pilkey. He's a co-author of Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores. This is KKRN 88.5. In your book, Dr. Pilkey, you talk about climate refugees, and we know that we're already witnessing the exodus of climate refugees from coastal communities all over the earth. Can you help us understand how many millions of people you expect in the United States and around the world will be forced to retreat, and also what it'll mean to real estate values and therefore our national and the world economy?
It's difficult to estimate the number of refugees, but in cities like Miami and Fort Lauderdale, the whole place will basically have to leave. It'll be something like the Dust Bowl refugees, and then the big exodus of people from the south to the north after World War II. But this will probably be a different kind of refugee. These will not be poor people for the most part. They will be well-off people who are seeking their fortune in another direction. One problem is that we are not thinking about this yet in this country. We're going to have to do some planning for this. And another thing to remember is that when this water first comes up under Miami and Fort Lauderdale and other South Florida cities, there may be at first there'll just be a few inches of water, but that's all it takes. A few inches of salt water is the permanently located there is the end of a city or the end of property. You wouldn't want to buy property where there is salt water there every day. Imagine what that does to your car and so forth. There is a 16-foot high ridge in Miami, and some people who are recognizing the problem have bought property there and building houses there. But the problem is that they will be pretty safe from long term future sea level rises, but everything around them is going to be flooded. So what do they do for groceries? What do they do for churches? What do they do for hospitals and so forth? So even though the water level might not be, because it's going to happen slowly, the water level may not be overwhelming, it'll still cause people to leave. It'll still make refugees, and of course the value of property will plummet. And I expect that the value is dropping. There have been some studies showing that, for one thing, the rate of increase of property values is dropping, and in some places the actual property value, like Norfolk, Virginia, Annapolis, Virginia, some of the properties there, and in Miami Beach, some of the property values there are actually dropping now. They're not plummeting yet, but the time will come when they will plummet. And that's why I say if my parents live there, they have passed on, but if they live there, I would urge them to get out now while they can sell their house. And they'll be looking for what I would call a greater fool, somebody who would be willing to buy the house even in spite of the problems. That money that they, from which they would sell their house, was and will be important to their retirement. It's some action is required, and I think smart people are really thinking. A number of people have already done this; they have already left in some communities. Better to do something now before the property values diminish.
I was in Miami back in 2015. Actually for a climate reality conference, Al Gore and about 1,000 other people. And I experienced what in your book you refer to as nuisance, tidal, sunny day or king tide flooding. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, the sunny day flooding is what's really happening now that's really important, that's really affecting. This is a flood that we're seeing already, which is due to sea level rise. Sunny day flood is caused by sea level rise pushing up the tide. The tides are the tides that have always occurred. You know, there is a spring tide when the moon is full, and then that's the highest tide. But when you add what's already happened in sea level rise, the tides are much higher than ever, and a lot of communities are being flooded, not by waist-deep waters or anything like that, usually by a few inches. A week ago in Alexandria, Virginia, saw a king tide, which is the highest of the high tides affected by sea level rise. And it came up to within 1 foot of the floor of the restaurant that we were eating at, and and the parking lot where people had parked to in order to get to the restaurant had 3 to 6 inches of water in it, meaning at worst, at least you'd have to get your, you might ruin your good shoes. So it's the sunny day flooding is what is threatening us right now. Sooner or later, instead of just flooding and coming back down, it's going to be permanent. But in some communities like Norfolk, Virginia, the sunny day flooding dates and times and expected elevation of the tide are published in the local newspapers. There's a church in the I think it's a Unitarian church in Norfolk that it has in the program every day, every Sunday, it has the tide gauge or the tide table, and the churchgoers know that when there's a sunny day flood, that they can't park in the normal parking lot. They have to park in a nearby condominium is. So they're planning for it. They're working on this. Miami, I think, is not planning and working on this as well as cities like Norfolk, where the big naval base is, and Annapolis, where the Navy Academy is. But sunny day flooding is just what it means. It's not flooding related to wind. It happens on calm days, and of course, if there's a wind on that day, then the flood is even greater. But by and large, it refers to flooding on perfectly calm days, which 20, 30 years ago we never would see.
What I thought was interesting in your book also about that is that the sea level, sunny day flooding, sea level rise, when a car is driving down a road and there's a foot of water, that salt water is not good for that car. And then there are signs, maybe it's in Norfolk, that say, you know, basically drive slowly because otherwise you'll create a wake, just like a boat would on a lake or in a bay area. And yeah. And that wake will push that water up into homes along the street.
Yeah, I think it's in St. Petersburg where they have, in Tampa, where they have signs, no wake signs on along roads, which you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
That's, of course, a thing you commonly see where boats are going up channels. But another thing you don't see in the photos of this is the fact that in Miami Beach, when these floods occur, when the sunny day floods occur, the sewers are let's see, the sewage is coming out of the sewers, and so there's a strong odor about it, and that's something you don't see in the newspaper. But that's another thing that has to be impacting on property values.
I've spent some time in Nicaragua. And in particular, on an island about 50 miles into the Gulf Coast, I guess it is, in Central America, called Little Corn Island. It's a 1 mile by 1 mile island. No cars are allowed. And And I stood on a bridge where on the one side was the ocean waters, and on the other side is kind of a freshwater lake within the island, and there's like a 1 foot separation there. So as sea level rise continues, we're talking about saltwater pollution of drinking water, and as you said in your book, even saltwater intrusion into farmlands, you know, that's an issue too, right? It's not just the sea level rise, but it's the the end of fresh water for some communities.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely true. The all along the East Coast here, from Maryland on down south, as you drive to the beach, you begin to see a lot of dead trees. Usually within about a half mile of the coast, you'll see all kinds of dead trees, which is a response to the intrusion of salt water into the groundwater, and which is killing the trees. That's of course is impacting on the fresh water supply of the various communities. Miami has a very serious problem of pollution by salt water of its fresh water. The we have some spectacular examples of some cases more than 100 acres of trees along the North Carolina coast, especially north of Beaufort, North Carolina. it's a very serious problem. In Hyde County, North Carolina, which is a rural county right on the edge of the coastal plain, 30% of the agricultural land has been destroyed by intrusion with salt water. And of course that's happening up and down the coast and here and there and various places. It's happening where the land is very, or the slope is very gentle and the land is very low. So
in Alaska, Eskimo communities are on the brink of extinction due to sea level rise. In the book you talk about sea ice that used to be 12 feet thick is now 4 feet thick, and the ocean is rising and eroding shoreline, destroying ancient villages. And then so there is this need to not just see that individual families will be moving, but entire communities need to be relocated. And in your book, you talk about the cost of that. I think in Louisiana, I think you quoted something like $800,000 per person. In Alaska, I think it was $250,000 per person. You know, it's kind of insane and not sustainable. Can you talk more about that aspect of sea level rise?
I think that the people who have the worst problem in North America, the worst sea level rise problem, or the worst problem for their future in this climate, global climate change, are the people in northern Alaska along the Chukchi Sea and also is happening in Siberia. It's happening in northern Canada. It's happening in parts of Scandinavia. What the problem is, first of all, back in the old days, about 40, 50 years ago, the beaches were always frozen by permafrost. I mean, the sand was virtually frozen, like a hard as a rock, on the beach, and so the waves weren't doing much damage. Now, the permafrost it melts down to sometimes a depth of 10 feet on the beach every summer. And the second problem is that sea ice would come in every September. That was the time when most places along the Chukchi Sea especially would expect to see the sea ice. And the sea ice would hold the ice. I mean, no waves. When there's ice there's no waves. And the third thing, of course, is sea level rise. But now the sea ice doesn't come until November, December. And in Barrow, Alaska, last year, it didn't come until January. So that means these communities, that the beach that is loose now because of permafrost is gone, is being struck by storm waves, and so we're having an erosion problem on top of the sea level rise, and this has become a very serious problem for the native Alaskans. And in fact, I think this group, there are 34 native villages that are impacted by this. And this group in all of America is not a large number of people, probably 10,000 people. Most of the villages are just 500 people. They can't be much larger than that and still be able to hunt and fish on the local system. So, but this is the worst problem facing the U.S. right now. The suggestion has been that these people can move to the big cities. Big cities meaning Kotzebue or Nome or Anchorage, which is a large city. But the problem is, there's kind of an unwritten problem here that they recognize, and that is that there's a strong tendency toward alcoholism. The villages, all the villages that I have been to, prohibit alcohol of any kind, and what are skilled fishermen and hunters going to do in the big city? Are they going to just sit around? So it's a very, very critical problem, and it's something that we've got to face, that the nation has to face. These are the last communities in America that largely live off the land. Not entirely, but they largely live off the land. We don't see any of this going on down in the lower 48 to speak of. So why not just move back? Well, it's difficult to move back because of the permafrost and constructing on permafrost. And then the fact is, if you could find rocks behind you, you can move the village there. But that's not going to happen in most places. So it's a serious problem.
If you're just tuning in, this is Doug Craig, host of Wake Up Call, and we're speaking with Dr. Oren Pilkey, the author of Sea Level Rise, A Slow Tsunami on America's Shores. This is KKRN 88.5. We'll be right back after this break.
Wouldn't
it be wonderful if we could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles? I want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to learn about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand, we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storms. King tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, king tide is a-coming, bringing flooding on a sunny...
Welcome back. We are on KKRN 88.5. This is your host, Doug Craig, on Wake Up Call, and we're speaking with Dr. Oren Pilkey, the author of Sea Level Rise. And I wanted to ask you, besides Florida, you list several cities that are at risk, including New York, Boston, Norfolk, Virginia, Virginia Beach, and Charleston, South Carolina,
yeah,
as U.S. cities most at risk from sea level rise. What is your view of how these different cities are preparing for what's coming?
Well, you know, each city, of course, is a little different. Like Boston, all of downtown Boston is very low. It's 5,000 acres are sitting on fill, that land that they dredged up from the bay and made new land. But, of course, they can eventually build a seawall New York City has a lot of elevation. However, the fringes of New York City, of Manhattan especially, are very low, just like Boston. And they are struggling now with the idea of building a what they call the big U, a big seawall around Manhattan that's in the shape of a U. Norfolk, Virginia is probably having the most problems of any small town or of any city of some small cities. This is the largest naval base in the world, they say, and the problem is that various neighborhoods are being impacted on by sunny day flooding, and this is makes it difficult for some of the workers to get to the naval base, and of course it's impacting on downtown of the city. They're going to build seawalls of sorts there, but they're not quite sure what they're going to do there. But the Navy base will certainly have to raise the docks, and certainly every port in the world will have to raise the docks eventually, and that's going to be a major expense and a major impact on commerce around the world. Charleston is a big problem. The bulk of the city, and what is called the peninsula of Charleston, is at a low elevation, and parts of it get flooded every month. Every normal high tide or spring tide, they get some flooding, and they now have a bunch of pumps in the city. They're trying to guide the water to certain depressions and then pumping it back out to the water around them. But that, I don't know. That's a tough one. It's difficult to say whether that's going to work. In terms of Barrier Island, now we have a 3,000-mile-long Barrier Island chain from the south shore of Long Island all the way to the Mexican border. And we have several communities. One of them is North Topsail Shores in North Carolina, and in the Gulf of Mexico, it's Dauphin Island. Both of these islands are very low elevation, narrow, and they should never have been developed, but there they are. They're developed now. And the main thing that we're doing for many of these communities, including Virginia Beach and Myrtle Beach and so forth, we're pumping sand, we're nourishing the beach or replenishing the beach. And replenishment, much of New Jersey, we're replenishing. Now, the problem with replenishing is that in North Carolina and New Jersey, the average replenished beach, which costs millions of dollars per mile, it lasts about 3 or 4 years, and it has to be repeated again and again and again. And they cost one beach, the most expensive beach that I know of in North Carolina was on Pea Island on the Outer Banks, and it cost $10 million a mile. There is a beach in New Jersey, I can't remember the name, where it costs the replenished beach cost $20 million a mile. $10 million and $20 million. That's a lot of money, and it's clear that this system of saving our communities is becoming somewhat unpopular. The it's costing so much tax money, and basically the real motivation for doing this is to save the beachfront property owners who were imprudent enough to build a house right next to an eroding beach. I think what we're going to see is more and more moving back of building, demolishing buildings and moving them back. That's probably going to be the only solution for our Barrier Island shoreline. I don't think the public will put up forever with nourishing the beaches when it when the sand disappears so fast.
You know, in talking about that, it reminded me about the part of your book where you discuss the National Flood Insurance Program and how it impacts all of us, all American taxpayers, regardless of where we live, because of what you're describing, where imprudent buyers purchase homes, and then the flood insurance program comes in and enables them to restore their home, and then it gets flooded again, and then it gets restored again. Can you talk about that particular insanity that we're dealing with?
Yeah, you know, the worst example of the problem, of the flood insurance problem, federal flood insurance problem, is in Dauphin Island, Alabama, where they have had five, starting with 1953, I think they've had five big storms that have wiped out the community. It's a very flat island, no dunes, nothing. It should never have been developed. But the federal flood insurance has paid buildings off, paid owners off repeatedly, some of them as many as five times. After their house had been destroyed or severely damaged. And this kind of madness of multiple payments for buildings and letting them stay in the same place without any change is crazy. I think, and the flood insurance program, the people who run it, FEMA, they and others, they know about this, but it really is going to take congressional action to stay. What they should do when a building has been damaged once and or destroyed, it should be moved, and or we should agree to pay for it once, and then if it happens a second time, that's your problem, no longer the federal government. So, and the overall, as you know, the insurance price. The cost of the insurance is not actuarial. It does not pay for the actual risk. The federal taxpayer, are taking most of that risk. So that's another very important aspect of coastal development on all of our coasts. That just we must look into that. It's going to take congressional action. Part of the problem is, beachfront property owners and in general people who live near beaches tend to be a wealthy and influential type of person and with a lot of influence on the Congress, and that's what's holding back, I think, is holding back the action.
Another concern that a lot of us don't often think about is as refugees flee the coast, they have to go somewhere, and so it's not just the coastal communities that have to worry about sea level rise, it's all the inland communities that will see this infusion of refugees coming to their community, and so a lot of those inland cities aren't necessarily prepared for how sea level rise will eventually affect them. Could you talk about that?
That is so true. That is so important, and this is not like the people that moved from the south to the north after World War II, where these were individual here and there. Now we're talking about massive numbers of people coming at once. It can be looked at as an economic opportunity for some cities who would like to have a lot, who would be willing to take it and could actually take advantage of having, you know, some educated people who could, you know, be involved in whatever industries they are trying to promote. So it is a possible economic opportunity, but it's more than an opportunity. It's a real responsibility of our society to take care of these people. We seeing sea level rise. Refugees in other countries, especially in Central America, some of whom are trying to come to the United States. We have something we can learn from other, like France. They had a big storm in 2010 called the Zina storm, and they, as a result of that, large number of people left the shoreline and moved inland, but nothing like our millions that we're talking about. We're talking about a few hundred, maybe a thousand or so. But what also happened, though, the French, right after the storm or shortly after the storm, they demolished 200 houses, small brick and concrete houses. And they reneged on, or they did not allow people to build future beachfront houses, which they had already permitted. They'd already given out permits. So there's something we can learn from that. That's another topic, though. Really, the problem of what we're going to do with these climate refugees hasn't even surfaced yet in our system. We need to give some thinking to them.
And I hadn't thought about it, but in your book you talked about refugees from the south, from Central America, countries like Belize, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Panama, that as sea level rise continues, you know, we think we have a problem now with refugees at the Mexican border trying to enter our country. You're talking millions of people fleeing Central America heading up this way in the decades to come, and we're not in any way prepared for that, are we?
Oh, we're not even thinking of that yet. Many people argue that many of the refugees who are clamoring at our border are climate refugees, not necessarily sea level rise refugees yet, but as you know, in a decade or two or three, we're going to have a large number of refugees. They've got to go somewhere when their home is destroyed by sea level rise, and that's another thing I'm sure we haven't planned on. And, of course, this is a global thing. Much of West Africa, big areas of West Africa are due for some disastrous flooding. And some parts, some cities, Jakarta and some other cities in Indonesia. In the case of Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, they have moved their capital to Borneo. Because of sea level rise. In that case, sea level rise is accentuated by rapid sinking of the land. So, and that's a multi-million people city. And looking at other places, Bangladesh is poster child, I guess, of disastrous flooding.
If you're just tuning in, this is a wake-up call. I'm Doug Craig, your host. We're speaking with Dr. Oren Pilkey. He's the author of numerous books of interest to us who study the climate crisis, and his latest book is Sea Level Rise. And the station is KKRN, 88.5 FM. Here in Redding, California, we're about 75 miles from Paradise, California, which you write about in your book. Almost exactly 1 year ago, as I'm speaking with you, the campfire nearly destroyed the entire town and sadly killed 85 people. You write in the book, although a fast-moving forest fire is different than a storm surge, the two types of disasters share the critical problem of escape of inhabitants who have the misfortune of being in the way. Please explain what you mean by that.
I looked into the escape problem from Paradise, and I find it startling, like the problem of escaping a hurricane, especially from a populous area. What we've done, I think we have now declared, I think there's a FEMA regulation now or something that says, when we have an interstate going into a city, all lanes will go outward, and no longer will we hold lanes one half of the interstate open for emergency vehicle. The emergency vehicles will have to find another way to get into town. And there have been some really bad examples of the hurricane that struck Houston lately. Well, Hurricane Rita was maybe the worst. What we see, though, in all the escape attempts and in Paradise, California, is people have fender benders, people have flat tires, people run out of gas, and I was fascinated by in Paradise, they actually took bulldozers to move some of the cars out of the way that were blocking traffic. And something like that has happened in an escape that was being made from Charleston, South Carolina, where they had to push cars out of the way. But that's a very serious problem, and that's why I urge people to, especially older people, and you got to face the fact whether you're old or not, especially older people, to leave early. Don't wait to be urged. Don't wait until they say, until they order you to leave. Go ahead and leave well ahead of time. And yes, sometimes you're going to leave for no good reason. It'll turn out the storm doesn't hit you or whatever. But that's okay. It's better to leave early and not create problems by the huge traffic jams. In Hurricane Rita, they had another problem. A lot of people left. A lot of people were part of the traffic jam that didn't need to evacuate. They hadn't been told to evacuate, and there was no sign that the storm was even coming to where they were. But they left. They left anyhow, and that's another. And that was. They, if they were going to leave, they should have left much earlier. Much earlier. It's a escape is a big problem.
Another issue that a lot of us don't always think about is the effect of sea level rise on hundreds of energy facilities, including 13 nuclear sites that are at risk of from sea level rise. Talk about that and why we really need to be worried about that one.
Map in the book that shows the locations of a whole bunch of important sites of oil refineries, nuclear power plants, regular power plants, wastewater plants, and all that. And all that are all at an elevation of 4 feet or lower. I think the story of Turkey Point nuclear power plant just south of Miami illustrates the point. They had a hurricane, Andrew, a while back, that pretty much struck right over the plant, and one of the stacks that was emitted, where they emitted waste, was blown over, and it didn't hit. Luckily, it didn't hit the reactor, but if it had hit the reactor, it would have been a disaster. The stack, instead, it hit a water tank. Well, they had planned for such an event, and they had men ready to come in to work on damaging the plant and so forth. They had equipment, and it turns out that they couldn't get to the plant not very quickly, because there are all kinds of trees across the roads, and so there was, so they hadn't even thought of that as a. These things have to be thought through rather much more carefully. We have another nuclear power plant on mid-central south of Florida on Hutchinson Island, and it is at an elevation of 3 feet. And I can't imagine why they would have built it at 3 feet. They say they plan for a hurricane, but I kind of doubt that. But in any event, the probably the biggest possible pollution problem we have in the United States is a hurricane coming up through up across Galveston Island and up the so-called Houston Ship Channel, which is the most polluted, maybe among the most polluted pieces of land, large piece of land. In the United States, there's a whole bunch of oil refineries and oil storage places and so forth. And in the hurricane that hit Houston, a couple of the refineries were hit, and spilling all kinds of oil and so forth. Wastewater plants or sewage plants are a big problem, because almost all of those are at low elevation. It makes it easier to pump the sewers down to the plant. So they tend to be right next to the ocean. In Los Angeles, we have a photo in the book of a large wastewater plant that it's right on the beach. It has a seawall in front of it, but it's still right on the beach. And there's other water plants and so forth. I think it's important for communities to look at their own shoreline and to see what have you got, what have you got that's going to be damaged by a storm surge or by strong winds. What can we do about it, and what should we do about it?
You've been listening to KKRN 88.5 FM. This is Wake Up Call. I'm Doug Craig. Our guest today has been Orrin Pilkey. He's the author of Sea Level Rise. And we just have about 30 seconds left, Dr. Pilkey, and just wonder if you have any final comments.
Sea Level Rise global climate change impact that's going to occur on every continent in the world, and is going to be a major impact on the U.S. We didn't even get into the problem of the military, where the military has, they have harbors and ports and docks and things all over the world. I think perhaps one of the biggest problems facing us is what we're going to do with climate refugees. Sea level rise refugees. We've got to start planning for that. We haven't even thought about that yet. So, anyhow, I have appreciated very much the opportunity to talk about this. It's so important. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for listening today. And coming up next is Tom Hartman. Thank you, Dr. Pilkey.
My pleasure.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles? We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to learn about the ocean's rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand, we're gonna feel it far inland. It's gonna shift the seasons and supercharge the storms. King tide.